But this is the point. The point is, in all cultures, in all religious philosophy, we see only the expansion of the central point, the natural feeling of faith and of simple piety, in order to broaden its horizon, to develop the potency embodied in it. It is necessary to pursue all the peripheral studies, the practical, the speculative, the intellectual, the emotional. All our studies, all our investigations are motivated by just one single motivation. I want to be me, or to be more clear, I want to be we. I realize that maybe that's the spiritual meaning when you're like a kid and you're on a toboggan, you're going down, you go, wee! I don't know, maybe that's what wee is all about. I don't know. Whenever I take my kid, I have this, my bicycle, I've got one of these seats in the back. So I say, Shmaya, now we say, we're having fun, so we go, wee! So it goes, wee! Questions? Yeah.
But I had a religious experience last night in the hotel tunnels. At the wall, at that portion where it's facing the Holy of Holies, it blew me away.
Right.
And I was just thinking, well, I had this experience, and I had this energy, and I felt this. And
right.
It was really palpable, real.
Well, there are certain places that are just such perfect mirrors that suddenly that truth you knew inside just was so reflected back to you. And Lakota is one of those places. I recall I was standing just at the bottom of these stairs over here, and a fellow's walking down the stairs, and he bursts madly into tears, sobbing. And he was like mid-40s, and I was not sure if I should move away from him because he's dangerous, or maybe I should talk to him. So I figured I'll talk to him. So I said, excuse me, is everything okay? Can I help you out? He said, oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much. Please help me. Can you tell me why I'm crying? So I said, I shouldn't have talked to this guy. I said, what do you mean, can I tell you why you're crying? You don't know why you're crying? He said, I am Jewish. I'm a taxi driver in Manhattan. That's enough to make you cry. But I'm a taxi driver in Manhattan. I don't know much about my tradition at all. But I know I'm a Jew. And I always wanted to come to the Holy Land. So this morning I got up and went down to the reception and I said, so what should I see in Jerusalem? They said, you should go see the Western Wall. I said, okay. So I'm walking down these stairs. I take one look at this wall and I'm sobbing. And I don't know why I'm sobbing. Right? So I start looking for Rabbi Meir Schuster to send this guy to Yeshiva fast. Now, but that was a moment where his soul just became so manifest. That was just a moment where this place was just such a perfect mirror that suddenly he saw into his soul, he connected to a truth that was so deeply buried. I'm a Jew, I'm a taxi driver, but you know what? It's just there. And this moment, now I can't say that I had such an emotional moment when I got to the hotel, my first time.
I did Monday at the wall outside, everybody, I kind of like felt, it's like, thank you, this one, is that all there is? I didn't feel anything.
Right.
But in the tunnels, opposite the
Holy Holies,
you felt
different. I didn't feel anything. I was like, right. The wall, I felt the same. I said, there must be a generator. There must be some current, you know, in here. It's like a setup. You know,
yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, and
but I want you to know there are some people that go even in there and don't feel anything. You have to understand sometimes, not sometimes, if we don't nourish that intuition, right, and we so confuse it, and we just start putting more junk on and more junk on it, we are deeply alienated from our inner self, our inner sensibilities. You know, I learned a very nice lesson when I went to buy my glasses, right? I went in there, and so you reach for a pair of glasses, put it on, you look, I don't know. So then you look at this glass, and they put it on the desk, that glass, you put it on the desk, and you got all these glasses on the desk, you go in the sugar, and then after like a couple of hours, you finally say, you know what, it's these ones, you put them on, right? So I said, okay, I'm going to get those. So the woman said, I want you to know, those were the first ones you picked. And I said, they were? She said, and I want you to know, this happens almost all the time. People come in, they go for that, but then they start thinking, and they start asking everybody, and they start really cognizing this whole thing, and well, what about this, and what about that, and how we'll go with these shoes, and how we'll go with that, and they go on and on, and they totally confuse themselves. when in the simple moment of knowing, they just knew. But they even forget. They even forget afterwards, after they've gone through this whole routine, where they basically come back to the simple, intuitive, direct knowing that they knew were the glasses for them. And she said it almost always happens. It's fascinating. There's a knowing that's so simple, so direct. But, you know, after a while, it's like, you know, it's like battering the witness. They get on stage. Did you see this happen? Yes, I did. Now, are you sure you saw? Well, yeah, I'm pretty sure. How could you be so sure? Well, I mean, I think I'm sure. And then you keep asking questions. And that's what happens to us. We get so philosophical. And we talk about it. And we beat the poor soul to death with just so much logical sticks. That after a while, you just don't know what's flying anymore. And so not everybody, their soul can break out of the prison of the bricks and mortars they built around themselves after so much confusion. Right? But sometimes it's a gift where suddenly there's this little hole and like a dam. You know, you put a little hole in a dam, it'll break through that hole. And that's what it says. Hashem says to do tshuva, all I'm asking you to do is open just the size of the eye of a pin. I'll do the rest. But if you just open up the size of a pin, the light that you are will so come radically shining out that things will be just so obvious. You really do feel like you've awakened from a sleep. And you just can't believe you talked that way, right? You acted that way, you thought that way, you thought that would bring you happiness. It's like, whoa, how did I get so lost? It's scary. It's the personal exile of the soul. The soul goes into its own Egypt, right? And sometimes to get out of Egypt could take a long time. It could be 210 years of slavery, pain, suffering, backbreaking, cruelty. Right? Problem is, the taskmaster is yourself. Right? I remember one woman who did Israelite. She said she had a dream during the program. Freaked her out. She said, last night I had such a vivid dream. So, you know, you have those dreams that you don't think it's a dream. I was in the dorm and I heard somebody come inside the apartment. It was dark. I couldn't see who it was. And I immediately felt that my life was in danger. And I heard that, felt that presence. I heard those footsteps. And I felt I had to run. So I ran out of my room and this person started running after me and I knew they were going to try and kill me. Right? So I opened up the closet door and I locked myself in the closet and this person started banging on the door, busting down the door. They finally busted down the door and they had a knife in the hand. They're about to kill me and I had a glimpse of their face and it was me. Powerful dream. True story. Right? That was her dream. Now that I told you this, I wonder what you'll dream about tonight. But anyways, and she realized that there was this inner self, that some external persona has been trying to kill. Powerful, powerful dream. But we can get so alienated, so disconnected, we can become our worst enemy. Right? And that's what all education is about. It's the expansion of that inner truth, that intuitive soulness. I know I'm a soul. I know I'm not an accident. I know I have meaning. I know I've come to this world to do something. And I can't believe in a God that doesn't like me, is trying to hurt me. That's ridiculous. That's as ridiculous as I'm trying to hurt my finger. Of course, I know I'm part of some greater soul. And that's really the question. It's not to believe or not to believe. We have to believe. We already believe. But what are you going to believe? And how are you going to express your soul in this world? How are you going to get what you know is true? I'm significant, I'm loved, and I'm growing. All right. What are you going to do?
How did he, okay, so is in Russia somebody who is just trying to express their divinity in a very destructive way?
Absolutely. Okay. It's the godliness of his soul that's making him so evil. He wants to be God.
They're not actually evil. Like, in their very essence, they're not evil. But they're expressing themselves in very evil ways. Or they're...
Exactly, because their essence is godliness. Right? The problem is they're so disconnected from how to genuinely express that, that because they sense such godliness within them, they think they are God. Right? That's what makes it so scary. That the Yetzirah, in essence, is not bad, but it's volatile. Its roots are holy. The Talmud tells a story about how the rabbis decided that the evil inclination for idolatry was so rampant, so out of control, that they would have to kill it. It's a very bizarre Talmudic story. So the rabbis together decide that they will decree and banish from the world the inclination for idolatry. Right? And when they did that, the inclination of idolatry emerged from beneath the Holy of Holies, under the Ark in the Holy of Holies, in the image of a fiery lion, and departed from the world. This is the most bizarre Talmudic story. Are you telling me that the inclination for idolatry, in its essence form, is rooted in the Holy of Holies? Yes, the Talmud says yes. So I asked one of my teachers, I said, no, I don't understand this Gemara at all. The first thing I don't understand is how could a person have an inclination for idolatry? I can understand people having this Yetzirah for money, or power, or sex, but I honestly have never felt this urge to bow down to a rock or a tree. Like, I can't fathom people having this urge, this uncontrollable urge, to bow down to rocks and trees. So my teacher said, David, that's because you're on not the highest level. I said, oh, I'm not on the highest level. You see, you have to understand what was so challenging to these people. They were so attuned to divinity that they were uncontrollable because they felt the divinity in the tree. They felt the divinity in the rock. So they were uncontrollably bowing down to trees and rocks. Right? Because imagine that. He says, you look at trees and rocks and you don't see the divinity in them. So you don't have a big challenge there. But they were so attuned to the presence of divinity within the natural world, but confused that, but God is one, beyond the world, within the world. But right now, viscerally, they're sensing this power within the tree, greater than themselves, and they wanted to bow and become part of that power. So the rabbis said, this is terrible, this is really, we got to get rid of it. So they got rid of it, but it was really rooted in the Holy of Holies. Right? And so true, so too, when you look at people who do destructive things, I'm not talking about just killing, right? But even destructive things to themselves, it's really rooted in the Holy of Holies. But it's going in the wrong place. It's manifesting itself. I mean, a person who's a drug addict, it's rooted in the Holy of Holies. They're really seeking a sense of a connection to beyond what we see with our eyes. They say that our brain is actually producing a chemical that most of the brain's operation is to filter out what's really here. Right? And so some of these hallucinogenic drugs are not hallucinogenic at all, but what they're doing is they're alleviating this chemical so that we can see what's really here. It's, again, it's a drive for God. But it's a mad drive for God. No seatbelts, right? Going on the wrong street, you know, down the wrong lane. It's destructive, but it comes from a holy place. And that's the problem. How can you help this person find a productive way to satisfy that inner spiritual soul need to experience my truth and to live it and express it? That's the challenge, right? That's really the challenge, yeah.
How do you know what's genuine and what's not?
Well, so that demands the totality of the person. You've got to use your mind, your brain, your heart, your gut, right? I mean, to me, it's like the Torah challenge, which is try and celebrate Shabbat 3 times in a row, right? And see what happens. See how you feel. Of course, put yourself in a community that is a good community. Don't do it by yourself. Like one girl said, well, Rabbi, I did it. I'm in a college dorm, and so I just closed the doors, and I lit my Shabbos candle. So, come on, you're really asking a lot. There's, you know, music blaring outside. Everyone's going partying, and you're going to be the loser who's not. I mean, come on. So, but set yourself up to really go to a Torah community and taste 3 Shabboses in a row, and then tell me what you know, what you experience about this. Is this real? Is this genuine? Does this work?
Okay, but Shabbat's enjoyable. I mean, like, if it's all Seder, for example, it's not enjoyable to eat and drink.
Oh, then you're at the wrong Seder. Right? You're at the wrong Seder.
You're at the wrong Seder, and you're right.
Right. But can you just imagine, just intellectually, not even experientially, shouldn't it be really a beautiful experience that a family gets together, the children are inspired to ask questions, we're going to share and talk about, right, our long history. Do you know why children are so sometimes so disconnected? Because there's no history. My friend went to Disneyland, and his mother, my friend is living a Torah lifestyle, his children are growing up a Torah lifestyle, his mother never raised him that way, so she's very challenged. They go to Disneyland, and at night, you know, they have the electrical parade, if you've ever been to Disneyland, okay, so they have this light parade, and as the parade came, his mother started to cry. He says, Mommy, why are you crying? She says, I don't know, honey, it's just so meaningful to share my tradition with my children. I mean, my grandchildren. I mean, like, these are the characters I grew up with. I mean, there's Goofy over there, there's Mickey. And like, you know, it's just so meaningful that they're sharing. Like, and he was looking at them like, Mom. I mean, okay, it's nice. I mean, it's nice. But share with your children, Moshe Rabbeinu. I mean, what did Mickey do for the world? I mean, Moshe Rabbeinu brought so much to the world. You know, it's like, come on. But that was her tradition. That was her feeling of connectivity with her children. And that's very nice. But it could be more. So you could imagine just the setting of a Passover table where children are asking questions and parents are answering those questions, and we're celebrating a miracle in our lives, and we're filling our hearts with a sense that miracles can happen. How could that not be a meaningful experience? Well, because we rush through it, we don't understand what we're saying, we start drinking all this wine too quickly, and we start going, right? We start eating tons and tons of matzah, which halakhically, well, there's exactly how much we should eat, but we didn't really read the book, so just to be sure, we'll eat 10 pieces of matzah to make sure that we fulfilled, you know, and so we get a little distracted from doing it right. So you need a teacher that can hopefully share with you how to run a Seder that works, right? But it could not work if you run it wrong. So that's true. I agree. But in general, I mean, I remember a fellow in the army came up to me and started arguing with me. He saw I had a kippah, so he had a million questions. It's a longer story than I need to share with you right now. But after he and I have like 2-3 hours of philosophical discussion, right? He says to me, look, I want you to know that I know that you religious people have a better life. After 3 hours of arguing with this guy, he now says this to me. I said, well, how do you know that? He says, I'm your dad. I said, how do you know? He says, listen, I live in a community, and from our apartment, from our window, we can see into the apartment across the street. And right across the street is this religious family. So I've grown up watching that family. Shabbat night, the parents are sitting with the children. The father blesses the children. The mother blesses the children. The father and the children go to synagogue. They come back from the synagogue. They're singing. He says, you know what we do Friday night? Nothing. Do you think we ever get together for meals? Never. And when we do get together, we just argue. So I'm not saying that happens to all secular families. I'm just saying this guy's story, which is it makes sense to have some kind of tradition in your life, some kind of format, something to celebrate, a history to be part of, a dream to envision. Right? It just makes sense it would work. You know, I mentioned to you that one of my publicists, who's really gotten involved in reading my books and reading our emails, she said, you know what, I wish I grew up Jewish. And I kind of really felt bad for her. What format does she have? I was on a plane and next to me was a born-again Christian fellow, really nice guy, and he was running this group of kids. And we have a lot in common in terms of values, and we have a beautiful discussion. He turns to me and says, Dave, you know, I actually turned to him and said, he turned to me and said, Dave, I've never been to synagogue. What do you do there? I said, oh, so I took out my siddur, my prayer book, and, you know, it's about yay thick. And I said, well, this is my prayer book. He goes, you say that every Sunday? I said, no, not on Sunday. No, let me show you. I said, here is my morning blessing for the week. Here's my afternoon prayer. Here's my evening prayer. And as I'm going through it, his eyes are growing wide and in shock, and his jaw is dropping lower and lower. Right now here, John, is my Friday night. And here is, and I suddenly, I had the gift of looking at my siddur in a total fresh way in the eyes of this man. And he was really shocked and jealous. I could see like the envy, like, you have this daily spiritual format? You know, and I was going, like, I was getting more and more upset. And John, I have this. And look at the musaf. And, you know, wait till you get my halal. And suddenly I realized, like, I have a daily spiritual routine. And sometimes it's just routine, but sometimes it gives me format in my life. Gives me spiritual structure in my life. So I turned to him genuinely and I said, John, I've never been to church. What do you do there? And he kind of was a little uncomfortable. He said, well, no, we don't have like a... So what do you do there? He says, well, we get together for 45 minutes. I thought, oh, I wouldn't mind that. Shabbat, 2.5 hours, you know. I said, uh-huh. And I said, and what do you do in those 45 minutes? He says, well, our pastor speaks for a half an hour. I said, oy vey. We can't handle a rabbi for more than 7 minutes. I went to one synagogue in L.A., and while I'm sitting there, I was a scholar in residence, so the guy sitting beside me says, are you the rabbi, the guest rabbi? I said, yes, I am. He says, uh-huh. You won't be speaking for more than 7 minutes, will you? Like that. I said, oh, I mean, nobody told me that, but I get... He says, you won't be speaking for... I'll be watching. I went, okay. And this is, I was looking at his watch as I'm giving the 7-minute drusha. So I said to him, oh, so half an hour drusha. Okay, I can handle not having that. And I said, what do you do for the other 15 minutes? He said, we sing songs from our hymn book, and the pastor picks one of the songs or two of the songs that like correlates to his sermon, and that's it. I said, no kiddish. What happened to those nothings with the sugar on it? Like you know, that was what he does. I said, so that's it? He said, yes. He said, well, actually, there's something else, but I'm embarrassed to tell you. So now I'm really interested. Yeah? What is it? Yeah, come on, John. Tell me, what do you guys do there? He said, well, there's something else that we do. It's called faving. Faving. F-A-I-T-H-I-N-G. Faving. Faithing. I said, what's that? He said, well, the pastor invites anybody from the congregation at the end of the service to come forth and share with everyone a miracle that happened to them that day, and they want to publicly thank God. So I said, wow, that's a beautiful idea. I think that's great. Why not bring that in shul? Why not have someone come up. I said, why are you embarrassed to share that? He said, because Dave, it's only happened twice this whole year that anybody volunteered to get up and share a miracle. And actually, you know, Dave, both times was me. You know? So he said, look, Dave, I got to tell you, church isn't like it used to be. It's a fashion show. I said, no. Really? And people, the bickering during the service, it's just disgusting. I can't believe that. And the politics in the church. I said, no. Right? He says, yeah, Dave, it's just not like it used to be. Not like it used to be. There's a priest, a priest that has been writing me, who's been reading my books. And I could tell he was very educated religiously, so I wrote him back. I said, are you a priest? He said, I used to be. I said, well, what do you do now? He said, I now run a home for the aged. I said, well, I wrote him back, emailing him, well, why did you leave the church? He said, because the church has become just another country club. And I didn't want to be the head of a country club. Right? It wasn't a house of worship. It was a country club. So, you know, religion is challenged in general. But what in many ways inspired me to kind of take a new look at myself as a Jew in Judaism was really a song by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. It really was. It was, you who are on the road must have a code that you can live by. And you know, I listen to lots of music, and still do. But not all lyrics, you know, stick in your head or kind of stay with you. But that really stayed with me, because I felt that I was on the road. Even though I wasn't a traveler, but I felt my life was a journey. And I felt I had no code, I had no map, I had no sense of bearings. So, at least look for a map, right? But just living a secular life means to miniaturize, shrink your life down to a grain of sand. Because in Jewish tradition, there's no such thing as secular, there's just chol, which has been translated as secular, but it really means a granule of sand. And that's a, you know, I'm not part of anything greater, I'm not committed to some cause. Not that there aren't people that are secular that are, but that's not secular, that's really then religious already, right? But a truly, purely secular life, which really most souls could never live. Because the soul just knows, I can't just be here, you know, so that I can eat as much ice cream and get as many deals and make a lot of money. The soul knows that. I'm just punishing myself when I live that lifestyle. That's all I really care about, right, is how much money I made. We just know in our hearts we couldn't have come to this world just to make money, right? Just wouldn't be enough. And it isn't enough. But that's sad. I met somebody the other day who is friendly with one of the wealthiest men in the world today. No names, but everybody knows these people. And he told me that this is the most insecure person he's ever met in his life. This guy is one of the wealthiest people in the world, right? And that his wife wanted to buy some jewelry from a woman that's really struggling, and she makes this costume jewelry. And it was like $250. And his wife was haggling with this woman who's really struggling to make a living on the price to get it down. Saying, listen, you know, I'm really well known in social circles. If I wear your jewelry, this will be good for you. Like, it's no problem for this person to spend the money on this jewelry. But you go like, what happened to your soul? Right? I'm not afraid of God's punishment, right? It's the hell you're creating for yourself by not expanding that central point, that simple emunah, that deep knowledge. I am a soul. I've come to this world to play a divine role. I'm a ray of divine light. So what's my lifestyle? What's my bearings? What's my map? Where can I go to celebrate? So even if some seders aren't so great, right, I think we can all see that if we play this right, this could really bring a lot of meaning and value to our lives. Right? I tell you something very interesting. I submitted two manuscripts to my publisher, which is one of the branches of Random House, and one is about the holidays, and the other one's called Uncommon Answers to Common Questions About Judaism, which is, who is God, why live the mitzvot, what is Shabbat, what is the Torah, why study the Torah, why pray, why celebrate Shabbat, why eat kosher, right? Now, this particular company, which is Shambhala, the imprint of Shambhala, they specialize in spiritual books. So to my absolute shock, they want to publish the holiday book first. And I said, no, why? I mean, Uncommon Answers to Common Questions of Judaism, I think, would be a better follow-up to the other book, which is The Secret Life of God. The holiday book, we think this will be a great seller. We've talked to the marketing, and we really feel that as we want to build your career, we think the next move has to be this holiday book. So I didn't understand it. I spoke to my publicist, my agent. I didn't understand it. I started to push them, you know, trying to take the other book first. And they said, no, believe us, this is the book that will sell better, and this will build up the sales for the next book. So I'm trying to figure out why. Then I spoke to the woman who worked on editing, and she said that she works for a yeshiva and interviews the girls that come into the yeshiva, and all the girls that go to this yeshiva come from assimilated backgrounds. She said all of them, when they talk about, well, what was your Jewish identity? It was the holidays. Right? Not kosher, not Shabbat. But they all said, well, we used to go to Rosh Hashanah service, or Yom Kippur, or we have a Passover Seder, Hanukkah, we do some things. And you know what? The truth is today that a Jew's connection with Judaism really is more the holidays. It's a much better sell than eating kosher, right? Because it, you know, and people like to celebrate. So I realized when this woman said that to me, I said, you know, these people are really right about their marketing. That Jews are more interested in holidays and the meaning, the inner meaning of the holidays, than they are about why celebrate Shabbat. You know, that's not so interesting to them. They're interesting.
Most Jews are holiday Jews, anyway.
What?
I mean, America was a holiday Jew.
Right, so there are a lot of Jews that still aren't connected to holidays, so if they could understand even deeper the meaning of the holidays, right? So originally, my suggested title of the book is You Are Loved, Tapping the Power of the Jewish Holy Days. They want to call it A Date with God. The inner meaning of the Jewish Holy Days. So it's kind of clever, A Date with God, because it's a date with God. Right? So they're very excited about that, and we're right now in heavy negotiations because I'm not so comfortable with the title. But it might be a brilliant marketing move. I don't know. That's a holiday. It's Shabbat.
We have Shabbat.
That's an interesting point. Interesting point.
It wasn't until I experienced what a real Shabbat was that it just blew my mind.
Yeah, yeah. I just got Tu Bishvat in there, so we can try to get Shabbat in there. Yeah, good point. But again, it's the format. The essence is there. The drive is natural. We can't help ourselves. Right? But we could hurt ourselves by picking a path or by starving our soul to the point that I'm so busting out to express what I know so true to be inside, and I just grab some cult or some charismatic leader who speaks something that sounds like what my soul could understand and appreciate. Right? And to me, that's really what's going on. The world is moving in a direction of religious fanaticism. Right? That's really the challenge. Right? It's not atheism anymore. Atheism is not a cultural phenomena anymore. Right now, it's hip to believe in God. When I handed in Endless Light to the publisher, he said, Rabbi, 5 years ago, I wouldn't even look at a book like this. A book about God, spirit, soul, wouldn't sell. He said, but now, the market's changed. God is in. Right, and sells books. And that's it. The best sellers are spiritual books. Right? I handed in a manuscript called The Me I Want to Be. And my publisher turned it down. I said, why? He said, well, this is not for this century. So why? He said, this is going back to the 70s. This is, I want to be your own best friend. I'm okay, you're okay. The games people play. The market has totally shifted. The market today is personal transformation through a connection to God. So I said, but that's what my book's about. Right? But he didn't like the title, The Me I Want to Be, which sounded like some pop psychology thing, but he was already jaded by the title of the book, right? That he wasn't able to see into the fact that this is all about how the self connects to that ultimate self, that source of all consciousness, and live the life of service. Because service is the theme of life. How can I be in service? So, but, you know, we're reframing the book, and now it's called Eye Contact. Eye Contact. And it's the journey from ego to soul. So we're working on re-presenting it to the publisher. But
you're kind of doing that with Kabbalah, though. I mean, Kabbalah is, you can't go like 3 days without seeing an article in front of the paper with violence,
Something very exciting is happening. There's an opportunity now. Okay, fine, but you know what? There is an opportunity. Suddenly, it's hip to be Jewish. I mean, when people hear that Madonna has mezuzahs on her doors, she doesn't do concerts on Shabbat. Okay, she's a bald tshuva, you know. I mean, you know, that she does concerts with Hebrew letters behind her. I mean, like, you understand what's going on here. As convoluted as some might think, I mean, a lot of Jewish kids are thinking it's hip to be Jewish. Or I'm not embarrassed because Madonna has some interest in something that's Jewish with Hebrew letters and putting on tefillin, or I don't know what she's doing in her. Like, this is really wild. This is actually an opportunity that we don't want to miss.
You're not worried about Kabbalah being something about sort of semi-involvement?
Well, yes, I am, because it's actually, on one hand, it's been good for the sales of my books and has also damaged the sales of the book. That's why in the third book there was a decision by the company not to have the word Kabbalah on the front of the page, on the cover. There's no mention on the cover, it's not the subtitle, because there's this concern that Kabbalah is becoming hokey, and that real spiritual seekers won't really trust you or value you if you're going out teaching Kabbalah. You're just not another one of these corporate Kabbalah books. So there's a double-edged sword going on over here. But you know what? God runs the world, right? And so everything that's happening is an opportunity if we choose to turn it into an opportunity. And there is an opportunity here that people are interested. They know that the Kabbalah is rooted in Jewish tradition. That they know. And there is interest. I mean, I have a friend who lives in a very affluent community. And I said, and I'd love to come speak in your community. He said, nobody will show up. And the community is about 80% Jewish. It's one of the wealthiest communities in the United States today. And he said, no one will show up. I said, just tell people it's about Kabbalah. Right? And you know what? He got a crowd. What can I say? There's an interest, there's a fascination. People don't know what it is, but they know that Madonna's doing it. And they want to know, well, what is she doing? What is she doing? So there's an opportunity here. And how to play off it is a whole other discussion. Yes.
Sometimes you're embarrassed to say religious things. And I know, obviously, it'll be a
right.
And a way we can be a light under the
right.
Nations.
So, just to clarify, I think the word religious has a stigma, and I don't think we're going to get over it. I don't think we need to get over it. That's why I tell people I'm a Torah Jew. And it's just creating a whole new language. They won't know what that is. So now you have a chance to speak to them about being a Torah Jew. But to try and reframe words that for so long have meant one thing and they've got this emotional reaction to it, what's the point? I remember I was speaking to a fellow in Florida, and we were talking about hopefully him funding something in the organization. And he said to me, you know, Rabbi, you really should go to, and he pointed to some very famous Jewish establishment. He said, you should go talk to them about money. So I said, well, quite frankly, I understand that they're really uncomfortable and not so receptive to Orthodox rabbis. So he turns and says, well, you're not an Orthodox rabbi. And now I've been talking to this guy for about 2.5 hours at this point. I said, well, look, and I don't like titles and labels and it divides us, but if I had to put a label, I guess I'd be called an Orthodox rabbi. He said, Rabbi, trust me, I know Orthodox rabbis. You're not an Orthodox rabbi. I said, okay, so make the phone call and get me into this place, you know, but that's the problem. And there's this terminology that has such a explosive reactiveness to it. I've got better things to do. I want to teach Torah, share Torah, right? And we'll get past the semantics later.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.